This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. In today's shadow, two industrial energy accidents in Arkansas, an oil pipeline spill, and a fatal accident at a nuclear power plant. Stay tuned for details. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Our lead stories today, two energy-related disasters in Arkansas involving an oil pipeline and a nuclear power plant fatality. First, an oil pipeline ruptured and leaked at least approximately 100,000 gallons of oil into a central Arkansas town on Friday. The Exxon-operated pipe was transporting a heavy form of crude from the Canadian tar sands region. The line gushed oil for 45 minutes before being stopped, according to local police. The crude oil ran through Mayflower, Arkansas. That's about 20 miles north of Little Rock. Two dozen homes were evacuated. The 20-inch Pegasus pipeline runs about 900 miles from Patoka, Illinois, to Nederland, Texas. Significantly, the line was carrying Wabasca heavy crude, which was fracked from Western Canada when it ruptured. According to Inside Climate News, Wabasca heavy is a form of diluted bitumen, or dilbit as it's called, from Alberta, Canada's tar sands. Because dilbit contains bitumen, a form of crude oil that's heavier than most conventional forms, it can be harder to clean up when it spills into water. 200,000 gallons of oil-polluted water have already been recovered, with Exxon and emergency responders preparing for a potential half-million-gallon spill. In tomorrow's 5 o'clock shadow, we shall discuss this frack-related disaster and the prospects in New York State and elsewhere for halting the XL fracking pipeline that would run from Canada to the Gulf of Mexico with Kate Hudson of the Riverkeeper Organization. Also today, the aftermath of Sunday's fatal accident at the Arkansas Nuclear Power Plants 1 and 2 in Russellville, Arkansas, operated by the Entergy Corporation, which also operates Indian Point in the New York metropolitan area. The plant's Unit 1 was offline for refueling when a 500-ton stator in the plant's turbine generator section collapsed due to the loss of external power, killing one worker and seriously injuring at least four other plant workers. The power flux also caused the scram or shutdown of Unit 2, which overnight released steam to help cool the remnant heat of the unit's hot nuclear core. We'll have further details today from former nuclear power plant operator and Fairwinds expert witness Arnie Gunderson, who is presently in transit but will join us with the latest details at the bottom of the hour. But first, this is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we now place the issues of nuclear power in perspective with our previously unbroadcast recording of the Union of Concerned Scientists' David Lockbaum speaking at the recently concluded medical symposium on Fukushima at the New York Academy of Medicine, convened by Dr. Helen Caldicott.
Thank you, and thanks to everybody. Thanks to Helen and PSR for sponsoring this, and thanks to everybody for taking time today and hopefully tomorrow on this important topic. It's not a surprise. Today is the second anniversary of the disaster at Fukushima. An earthquake and the tsunami it fostered caused three reactor core meltdowns and forced tens of thousands of people to leave their homes. Next slide, please. Was it shock and awe, a tragic surprise that could not possibly have been foreseen and avoided? No. Was it shock and awe? No, it was all shucks. It was a series of foreseeable hazards that just weren't dealt with responsibly that triggered the accident. The disaster began with an earthquake measuring 9.0 on the Richter scale. Not a surprising challenge. The Fukushima plant had been designed for severe accidents, and all available evidence suggests that all safety systems survived the shaking and were cooling the reactor core as intended. But the earthquake extensively damaged the electric power grid to which the plant was connected. When the plant was running, it's supplying electricity to the grid. When the reactors were shut down, it needs electricity from the grid to power the pumps, the motors, the dampers, the lights, and everything else that needs to cool the reactor cores. It had long been known that the grid was not protected against earthquakes even smaller than 9.0 and could fail. Forecasting that the grid might be lost, workers had installed more than a dozen diesel generators at Fukushima. One diesel generator per reactor was all you needed to cool the safety systems to prevent reactor core damage. The rest provided backup safety. When the earthquake took away the normal power supply, these emergency diesel generators automatically started and were providing power to the equipment needed to cool the reactor cores. In addition to taking away the normal power supplies, the earthquake also generated a tsunami that arrived about 45 minutes later. Forecasting that someday the Oceanside plant might experience tsunamis, workers had installed a seawall, protective seawall, around the plant that was nearly 15 feet tall. Unfortunately, the tsunami that day was nearly 45 feet tall. Years earlier, researchers in Japan had forecast that the site might receive a tsunami wave close to 46 feet tall. But the plant's owner and the regulator dismissed this foreseen hazard on the grounds that it was overly speculative and not substantiated. It's now been substantiated. No changes were made to the Fukushima seawall. The diesel generators for the three reactors operating at the time of the quake were located in the basements of the turbine buildings, the buildings closest to the waterfront. Tsunami waters, scarcely impeded by the short seawall, inundated the site and flowed into the turbine buildings through open doorways and ventilation system louvers. The diesel generators stopped running as the water submerged them. All of the diesel generators had been placed in the basements of these buildings. This placement afforded the greatest protection against earthquake motion, but the least protection against flooding. Consistency is an overrated quantity. Inconsistency improves the chances that you're right some of the time, even if you don't know when that is. Put another way, diversity is your ally. If you mix up how you do things, chances are you're going to get some of it right, again, even if you don't know when that is. But the company put all of its eggs into one soggy basket. Forecasting that the electric grid might be lost and that the diesel generators might someday fail, workers had installed banks of batteries with sufficient capacity to power one safety system for up to 8 hours. But some of the backup power supplies were also disabled by the floodwaters, and the surviving battery banks were only capable of providing power for 8 hours. The plant was without power for 9 days. 8 hours is much less than 9 days. Forecasting that multiple safety systems might occur someday, workers had developed procedures for using backups to the backups and using diesel-powered pumps on fire trucks and barges to provide makeup cooling water to the reactor cores. But the pressure inside the reactor vessel or the pumps produced enough pressure only against one quarter of the pressure inside the reactor vessels. In other words, you needed to reduce the pressure in the reactor vessels for these pumps to be able to send water in. Forecasting that it might become necessary someday to lower the pressure inside the reactor vessel, workers had installed valves that could vent the reactor vessel and into the containment building and vent the containment building to the atmosphere. But these valves needed electrical power to work. Anytime you use a backup clock in the control room to tell you what time it is, you're in trouble. In cruel irony, three reactor cores at Fukushima faced the threat of overheating due to ocean waters that flooded and disabled the backup power supplies and the equipment they powered. The power loss also prevented workers from using the backup to the backup systems. Sitting literally a stone's throw away from the Pacific Ocean, a fairly large body of water, three reactor cores faced meltdown due to lack of water. forecasting that reactor cores might someday overheat and melt down, producing large amount of hydrogen as the fuel melted down. Workers had installed systems to purge the air inside containment and get rid of the hydrogen. Even before the plant started up, systems were installed to replace the containment air with nitrogen, so that as the hydrogen was released from a damaged core, it would mix with nitrogen, no oxygen was present, and it could not explode. But the accident caused the pressure inside the containment building to go very high and forced that hydrogen into the surrounding reactor building, which does not have nitrogen in it, except for the nitrogen that came from containment. So the same thing that caused the containment to fail caused hydrogen to get into places it was not supposed to be. There were instruments provided inside containment that allowed workers to monitor the amount of hydrogen, the amount of oxygen inside the containment, and to vent the containment when it became necessary. There were no instrumentation at all inside the reactor building to monitor the hydrogen or the oxygen concentrations. That was the first clue workers had that hydrogen was in places it shouldn't be. It's a little bit late when that's your clue that things are going awry. Hydrogen gas escaped from the containments into the surrounding reactor buildings. I went through that. That's the unit 3 that Arnie already showed. And the result was 3 reactor buildings, al fresco. No roof, no walls. Took a while to do that, too. It didn't happen all the time. With all these forecasts of hazards that were identified, the only surprising thing about Fukushima is that no steps were taken to manage the hazards. The warning signs were all there for many, many years prior to that disaster. One only needed to heed rather than ignore the warning signs. The 3 reactor meltdowns forced tens of thousands of people to evacuate their homes, and they're not going back anytime soon. The Japan Center for Economic Research recently estimated that the cost of Fukushima was somewhere between $71 billion and $250 billion in U.S. money, or U.S. dollars. It's not going to be our money. This includes $54 billion to buy the contaminated land of people who had to leave their homes within 20 kilometers, and $8 billion in order to compensate the residents. Even if the actual price tag ends up being at the low end of this $71 to $250 billion range, that cost far exceeds what would have been a prudent safety investment years ago. Had the electrical grid been fortified to withstand an earthquake, the continued availability of electric power would have prevented this disaster. They would have had electrical supplies for the workers to use any number of equipment that was already there. Had the seawall been raised so that the height was taller than the tsunami wave, the combined availability of the normal power supply and the backup power supply and the backup to the backup power supplies would have prevented this disaster from occurring. Had the diesel generators and associated electrical buses been located at some at high elevations, some at lower elevations, the likely availability of some of this equipment would have prevented the disaster that occurred. Had the battery banks been installed such that some of them would have survived the tsunami wave, and the rest of them would have lasted more than 8 hours, an artificially short period of time, the disaster would have been averted. Had workers been given a viable plan if all 3 of those things failed, the disaster would have been averted. The cost of all of these measures, had they been taken, would likely have exceeded $71 billion. The costliest item on that list, hardening the electric grid itself likely would have cost more than $71 billion. But it would not have been necessary to pay for all of the upgrades, or even the most expensive of those upgrades. All they would have had to do was pay for one of those upgrades, even the cheapest one, and we wouldn't be here today. Symposiums are not held to talk about disasters that have been avoided. If a taller seawall had been erected around the site, none of the other safety measures upgrades would have been needed. The taller seawall would have kept the tsunami in the Pacific Ocean instead of on the Fukushima plant, and the safety equipment would not have been flooded and taken off the table. Unless you'd have built the seawall with gold, it's hard to imagine that the taller seawall would have cost more than $71 billion. If each Fukushima reactor had been constructed with one diesel generator low and one diesel generator high, and provided air-cooled diesel generators so you didn't need the cooling water for the diesel, likely one of the diesels, at least one of the diesel per reactors, would have survived even the shorter seawall and prevented the disaster from occurring. I worked at a plant here in the United States that added an additional diesel generator. It was $100 million, considerably less than $71 billion. If each Fukushima reactor had been equipped with the means to reduce the pressure inside the reactor vessel and containment so that the diesel-driven fire pumps that were sitting there could have actually worked, the disaster would have been averted. Independent battery packs and compressed air cylinders is all they would have needed to get those valves to work. That's ultimately what they used, because they went out to the parking lot and took batteries out of cars and went to a contractor shop to get compressed air cylinders, but they got them too late, not in time to prevent disaster, in time to mitigate it. So all the hazards that factored into Fukushima's tragedy had been foreseen for many years and had fixes readily sitting on the shelf waiting to be installed. Severe accidents like the one at Fukushima keep occurring because nuclear plant owners and their owners keep pretending they cannot happen. Pretending is to protection like guessing is to knowledge. We have the capability to protect against these hazards. Nuclear power plants can be built and operated successfully against known hazards. We struggle against unknown hazards, but we have no excuse for operating plants vulnerable to known hazards. We only need to match our capability to handle these known hazards with the will to do so. When researchers concluded that Fukushima might experience a tsunami taller than its seawall, that should have led the nuclear plant owner and the regulator to evaluate whether we need to build a taller seawall or take other steps, like relocating emergency diesel generators or providing a reliable backup, so that something survives the tsunami threat that you know you're vulnerable to. It's okay to pick the cheapest from amongst those options, unless the cheapest is to do nothing against a known hazard. That's irresponsible. People should go to nuclear jail when they make those decisions. And you could have followed that process for any one of these hazards. Anytime the battery power was only designed to last for 8 hours, somebody should have answered the question, what happens at the ninth hour? If the answer to that question is we hope for a miracle, we distribute rabbit's foots, go back to the drawing board, come up with a different solution. That's the wrong answer to that question. The reason they didn't get a wrong answer to that question is they never asked it. The easiest way to duck a question is not to ask it. I had a department head in college who said it doesn't matter to have all the right answers until you've asked all the right questions. They didn't ask all the right questions, and they're paying a high price. So plant owners and regulators can consider setting a protective standard less than a known hazard as long as there's an evaluation shows that there's something other than luck and miracles that will step in to save the day. To further illustrate how this works in practice, consider for a moment if the disaster at Fukushima had been caused by an asteroid impact. It's unlikely that asteroid shields would now be being built around plants in Japan or elsewhere. The answer to that what-if question involves little changes at plant sites and likely involves more changes in our ability to detect incoming asteroids. How has Fukushima affected nuclear safety here in the United States? Some claim it cannot happen here. If the "it" they are referring to means the status quo that allows the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to pretend these things cannot happen, they are right. It cannot happen here. We're not ending that status quo, apparently. If the "it" refers to severe accidents, they are dead wrong. Prior to Fukushima, the NRC learned about a plant in South Carolina that could be flooded to a depth of 13 feet, a foot higher than Fukushima. The NRC's own risk analysis calculated there was a 100% chance that all three reactors at that site would melt down if that occurred. Very little has been done other than hide the documentation about this threat. A hallmark of nuclear safety is defense in depth, a normal and a backup system, a backup to the backup, to make sure that you have core cooling even if a single failure occurs. But when that single failure is underestimating the likelihood of severe accidents such that you take no measures to protect against them, you're setting yourself up for Fukushima. We've done this again and again over decades. There are no nuclear surprises. The only thing surprising is why we continue to do that. One of the definitions of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, hoping for a different outcome. It doesn't work. The technology is too unforgiving. So had Fukushima aimed higher on just one of the barriers I went through, just one, not all of them, just one, we wouldn't be here today. But more importantly, tens of thousands of innocent people would be back in their homes with their belongings, enjoying undisrupted lives. That's not the case. For them and for millions of potentially innocent victims tomorrow, we must do a better job protecting against known hazards. Thank you.
Dr. David Lochbaum of the Union of Concerned Scientists, speaking recently at the Fukushima Medical Conference convened by Dr. Helen Caldicott and assembled at the New York Academy of Medicine.
Prize is the marriage of free. exemption in commerce, that was mine. I prefer a palace to a circle every time. I prefer to make a beat that wipes a village from the map. I prefer a fallen halo when it's dancing on your lap. Are you perverts having fun yet? It all comes out gray and matters less with each sunset. Here come upon the sound of our language, the sound off kilter with casualties pending. The pact is death, the action packed ending. It's not sarcasm, we're training eyes. Hands are weak and see them, ass in the sky. Asinine lies for assassins we need. A motive for making that human ink bleed. Champions, fly. Calling all living, affirming all dreams. Screaming all hell, as real as it seems. Rescind your explosions, get up off toes. Kids are at attention, tending towards pros. Smoldering shows, shoulder all comers. Dirty old bushmen, your season is waning. Sorry about these big f***ing lumber. Ignite a new kind of soul, music, father and mother. Here come the heat, nuclear summer. More pressure, more fire, more peace, more fire. More people, more honey, more heat, more fire. More voice, more deep.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And recapping our major stories today, there was a major oil spill on a pipeline that contained heavy petroleum that was brought from the tar sands of Canada into Arkansas. Dozens of houses have been evacuated, and a great deal of material is already being collected with expectations of 500,000 gallons of spillage to have occurred from that. Our other major story today is the overnight disaster at the Arkansas nuclear power plants 1 and 2, where what appears to be a failure of external power led to the collapse of what is called the stator. That is a part of the generator system downstream of the nuclear power reaction that in conjunction with a rotor, creates the rotational magnetic or electromagnetic process that generates the electricity that is sent out. But the plant depends on the external energy coming in. And in order to understand exactly what happened in Arkansas overnight, we are happy to be joined by Arne Gunderson, a former nuclear power plant operator and expert witness with Fairwinds Associates. And welcome once again. So good to have you, Arne Gunderson, on 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Hi, Robert. It's nice to be here.
Well, thank you for taking this special time to be with us today. And some news reports are calling it a nuclear accident. I believe you would refer to it as an industrial accident. What happened in Arkansas last night?
Okay. The nuclear reactor is in one building, and it creates incredibly hot water, runs it through something called a steam generator, and goes back into the reactor. And that's a closed loop. So in theory, all the radiation is inside that one building called the containment building. On the other side of that steam generator is steam. That's what's coming out of the steam generator that turns a turbine. And the building that the turbine is in is huge. It's as big as a football field. There'll be three turbines in a row. And at the end of the turbine is the electrical wires that spin, called the generator. And that piece of equipment is incredibly heavy. It's 500 tons due to mass, and it works out to be 1,000,000 pounds.
That's about 200 or 300 automobiles.
Yes. So they were lifting that piece out for a repair, and they had it up in the air, and they dropped it. So they dropped a 1,000,000-pound piece of metal, and unfortunately, four employees were injured severely, and one was killed when the 1,000,000-pound hunk of metal fell to the floor. But this is on the industrial side of the plant. This is the almost non-radioactive side of the plant. There might be a small amount of radioactivity, but so this person was crushed by a million-pound piece of steel that fell from a heavy lifting crane.
Artie, if I understand correctly from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission mandated event report, this disaster involved a loss of external power to the plant, and that in turn cascaded into a scram or a shutdown of Unit Number 2. And according to that report, there was what they called the natural dissipation of the remnant heat from the other reactor shut down. The control rods were reported to have been correctly inserted. However, the cooling of that involved what is called steam releases. Can you explain that part of the process for the other plant as well?
Yeah, there's two reactors on this site. The one that was shut down, they were repairing the generator on. And there's some description of some sort of an electrical explosion. It could be that as they were lifting this heavy component, the electric current became so great that there was an explosion. But in any event, there was an electrical explosion that in the plant that was being repaired that somehow or other caused the second unit, which was running, to trip offline, to scram. And the control rods fell in and the reactor shut down. But remember from Fukushima that you've got all this decay heat. Shutting a reactor down doesn't make the heat go away. So they had thousands and thousands of horsepower of heat that still had to be dissipated. So what they do is, remember, there's one side of this reactor that's radioactive, and on the other side of this steam generator is non-radioactive steam. What they do is they take that non-radioactive steam and they open valves and they blow it out the roof. And that's called an atmospheric dump. So they're spraying, hopefully, non-radioactive steam out the roof of this power plant in order to get rid of the decay heat.
At the root of this tree of cascading catastrophes is involved the loss of external power to the plant. And Arne Gundersen, you have spoken many times on 5 o'clock Shadow about the counterintuitive vulnerability of a nuclear power generating station to depend upon external power. Can you speak more about that?
You're right. It is counterintuitive. A nuclear plant is supposed to generate power, but when it shuts down, it needs power to keep it cool. In this case, the one unit was down for normal refueling, but the other unit was running, and somehow a spark from the reactor caused a voltage fluctuation that shut the second reactor down. At that point, it needs external power, and it didn't have any. Hmm. So both diesels fired up. There's emergency diesels on site. And the emergency diesels are keeping the lights on at the power plant now. That doesn't mean that the decay heat doesn't continue. You know, it has to be cooled. And the process of cooling it normally is to vent the steam that's being produced out the roof on the non-radioactive side of the steam generator.
Residual heat from the fission reaction of a nuclear plant is an issue that has also occurred at Fukushima, not only inside the reactors, but at the spent fuel pool. Can you speak more about that, as you did so cogently at the recent Fukushima conference at the New York Academy of Medicine?
Well, the first unit was already being refueled, and it's not clear whether all of the fuel was in the nuclear reactor or part of it was already in the fuel pool on the first unit. That's a critical difference because if all the fuel was over in the fuel pool on the first reactor. This is the one with the industrial accident. The NRC does not require any backup diesels. They claim that you can boil the nuclear fuel pool and replace it with fire hoses. But the reactor that was running, the one that scrammed, definitely needed the diesels to cool it, because the heat output would be something on the order of 500,000 horsepower initially, and then it would gradually decay away. So you can imagine the noise that a steam dump creates when all at once you're dumping, you know, something on the order of 300,000 to 400,000 horsepower of steam directly into the atmosphere. It shakes the building. I've been in that situation.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow. Our guest is Arne Gundersen, expert witness with Fairwinds Associates, FAIREWINDS.com. And Arne, what is your take on the significance of the major Fukushima medical conference in which you took part and we broadcast here on 5 o'clock Shadow?
Well, first off, thank you very much for broadcasting it. We had 4,000 people listening to the online streaming of it, and then, of course, I'm sure you've got 4 million visitors on your to your site, too. So we had lots and lots of people. I really appreciate that. Secondly, though, you know, the nuclear industry has circled the wagons both in the United States and in Japan, and is basically making the argument that, yeah, it was a really bad accident, and the plant is useless, but nobody's going to die because there wasn't enough radiation thrown out into the atmosphere. And the conference, I think, pretty definitively showed that that's not true. We are going to have, you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of cancers as a result of the Fukushima accident. And the Caldecott Foundation put on the conference, and it's important to get an alternative voice out there to a very well-funded nuclear industry.
One of the things that is important to understand is the vulnerability of nuclear power plants, but also the econometrics, get-out-of-jail-free card economically that has been given to the operation of nuclear power for electricity, a small part of the nation's total energy budget, that basically exculpated the operators from what in any other industry would be great liabilities. Can you speak about the economics beyond the physical vulnerabilities of these plants?
Let's look at the Arkansas plant and Indian Point. They're all owned by Entergy, as is Vermont Yankee up here in Vermont. What the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has allowed them to do is spin off each nuclear reactor in something called the Limited Liability Corporation. So the only assets of the of each separate nuclear reactor down in Arkansas and each separate nuclear reactor on the Hudson River just north of you, they're only assets when the plant is running. And the minute the plant becomes uneconomical, Entergy, through this limited liability concept, can shut it down, and the damage to Entergy is nominal because the capital stops flowing in, but there's no economic disincentive for them because they don't have to pay the cleanup. The cleanup after an accident or a surprise shutdown is captured. The costs, the liabilities, are captured within the limited liability corporation, so it never trickles up. Cash goes up, and liability does not, in the way the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has allowed these things to operate. The second piece, of course, is insurance. And, you know, you and I are subsidizing the insurance on these plants. They can't get insurance, but through Price Anderson, all the taxpayers in the country are on the hook for a nuclear accident.
Are there any initiatives to rectify the recklessness of Price Anderson?
There have been several. Price Anderson originally started out in the 50s as a five-year deal to help the industry get started. And every 5 years, it gets renewed for another 5 years. Then the industry clearly knows that if it doesn't get renewed, the plants will be forced to shut down because they can't afford their own insurance. So there's been a few brave senators and congressmen who've brought that topic up. But, basically it's a stacked deck in Congress. We don't have Republicans and Democrats on nuclear. They are all pro-nuclear. And we're just not going to make any headway on Price Anderson within any Congress that we've had or anyone that's foreseeable. I hate to sound so gloomy about that, but that's a fact.
So we have a bi-isotopic legislative branch.
Yes, you're right. I love it.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight. That's Arnie Gunderson. And Arnie, I think, are in undiscovered territory with regard to nuclear power plant operations in the United States. And you have spoken very urgently about the dangers that we face because of the aging of nuclear power plants that are being renewed even as we speak for decades beyond their planned lifetime. You have discovered embrittlement, cracking, and such things. Can you tell us what kind of dangerous jalopy we're riding with many of the nuclear power plants in this country?
Well, the oldest nuclear plant that's ever run has run 47 years, and it was shut down. And now we've got a couple reactors in the United States that are pushing 44 years. So they're right out at the edge of where these plants have ever been mechanically. There's a thing in reliability engineering called the bathtub curve, and if you think of sitting in an old bathtub, that's the shape of the reliability curve. Initially, a plant is unreliable, like a car is unreliable, and you shake out the bugs, and then it runs very well. That's the flat bottom of the bathtub. But eventually, the age of the plant starts to creep up on you, like I'm beginning to feel, as a matter of fact. So the curve on the opposite side of the bathtub is not taken into account by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We're seeing more scrams, more unplanned outages. In the United States now, we've got four nuclear reactors shut down because of serious mechanical problems that are age-related. None of that is in the NRC's analysis. That backside of the bathtub curve, the NRC just believes that if you follow the regulations, you will never age, and the plants will be able to continue to operate. Most plants in the country now are licensed for 60 years, despite the fact that the oldest plant that ever ran was 47. So we're way out beyond where experience would lead us to believe.
Well, Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates, I thank you for joining us today with an up-to-the-minute briefing on the overnight disaster at the Arkansas Nuclear Power Plants 1 and 2 and the tragically fatal and serious injuries imposed upon at least four workers, and we expect more details to emerge as time goes on. And I'd like for our listeners to know how they can follow your kind of astute representation of what is really happening in nuclear affairs today.
Well, we have the website is fairwinds.org, and Fairwinds has an E in the middle of it, and Gunderson has an E in it, too. We like E's up here. we have podcasts that come out every Wednesday, and then larger feature videos, and something called Demystifying Nuclear Power, which is in a written format that we try to address some issues of the day. And we have RSS feeds and all that kind of stuff for people who want to stay on top of it. We've had about 10 million visitors to the site since Fukushima Daiichi, and Huffington Post said we were the go-to site on technical information, so I'm pretty proud of that.
Well, thank you once again, Arne Gundersen, on the spot with significant and knowledgeable details about the overnight nuclear disaster in Arkansas. And we shall continue to be in touch with you about relevant breaking developments on this and other stories. Thank you once again, Arne.
All right. Thanks, Robert.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and we'll be back right after this.
In the control room, can you hear it? There's an alarm, should we clear it? Don't be afraid of a thrown turbine blade working at a nuclear power plant. Gone away is our heat sink. Should we scram? What do you think? We'll reset the sun and start another pump working at a nuclear power plant. In containment, we can build a snowman and pretend he's from the NRC. He'll say, are you in spec? We'll say, no, man. We're high on our condenser, Delta T. Later on, we'll conspire not to talk about the fire. What's with all the gloom and doom? It's not that big a plume. Working at a nuclear power plant. Cock the rods, shoot some water. Pay the fuel, it's getting hotter. We're watching reactor multiplication factor. Working at a nuclear power plant. In containment, we can dim the lights now. Sit around and watch the deep blue glow. Not much fun if you're afraid of heights now. To run the polar crane and look below. Later on, we'll inquire why the flaw rate is climbing higher. There's no need for commotion. It's just carbon steel corrosion. Working at a nuclear power plant. Working at a nuclear power plant. I love working at a nuclear power plant.
Pity File. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. And we'd like to give thanks today to the excellent engineering by Michael G. Haskins and to you, the listener, for supporting WBAI. We urge that you continue that support with a click to give to WBAI.org. Give numeral to WBAI.org. And with Michael G. Haskins, and on behalf of the WBAI staff, we welcome your comments, questions, tips, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@WBAI.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.